Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago, joined again today by Rob Hunt of Lanay Holdings out in San Diego. And folks, if you're tuning in, you've picked probably one of the best shows you could tune in for. We are really, really honored today. We have Tony Saunders is in the studio with us, and in a minute we're going to be having a chance to talk to him. And if he tells half the stories that he was just sharing with Rob and I before we logged on, this is going to be a show you won't want to miss, and you're going to want to pass out to your friends, because we all love Jerry, we all love Merle, and nobody knows him better than Tony. So we're very excited to dive into that. We've got some of Tony's music, and we're going to lead into one right now for everybody before we get going here. And this is a bass solo that Tony did on the Keystone Revisited album. Wow, well, that is that's great bass. What can I say? This is just wonderful. Rob, how you doing? And what a way to start a show, huh?
Yeah, look, I'm so fired up. I'm such a big fan of Tony Saunders' music and such a big fan of all the things that he's accomplished musically over the last 47 years or so that I've kind of known him since he started playing with the Garcia Band back in 1974 or 75. When he first came on my radar, and obviously I was a big fan of his father's music as well, and I can't even tell you how thrilled I am to have him in the studio with us today. So without any further ado, let's dive in. Tony, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us today, man. I'm so psyched to meet you.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I think that, I've been playing bass now 53 years, and it all started by, my dad would take me to sessions, and at first I played piano, and my dad would take me to sessions when he was on. So when I got, I was in high school, I went to a session. They were doing the soundtrack for Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland, Clute, for the movie Clute, with Taj Mahal, sure. Jane Fonda. You know what I'm saying? I met Jane Fonda. I'm like going, dang, she's even finer than you know, I'm just a kid, but I'm going, I know that that's a beautiful woman. So I'm not one of those kids who didn't want to be like their parents when they grew up. I'm the kid who wanted to be exactly like my dad when I grew up, because what a lifestyle. I mean, you know, a lot of first happened at his shows. You know, girls, I first noticed girls liking me, you know, at their shows. And, you know, I saw the rock world, and I idolized John Kahn. And what's really cool is we lived on Page, and my grandparents lived on Page and Ashbury. So in 1960,
in Berkeley,
in San Francisco, in the Haight-Ashbury, they lived right down the street from the Grateful Dead house.
That's amazing.
Little did I know that in 1965, I was 10 years old. I turned 10 in 1965, but that's where the hippies came. And there was music in the park. Girls with see-through shirts. You know, so I threw away my Playboy magazines. I didn't need that. My grandmother would go, "You guys sure have finished your chores quick." I said, "I know, man, I got to get up on Haight Street. You won't believe what's going on up there."
When you were 10 years old, Tony, that means, you know, Janis Joplin was running around, Quicksilver Messenger Service was running around, the Grateful Dead, obviously, Moby Grape, like all these bands are right in your backyard as you were a 10-year-old kid learning how to play music.
They were playing in the Panhandle every week. Every Saturday and Sunday, there's music in the park. And after I did my church stuff and practiced my piano lessons, I got to go to the park and play with, and not play with them. I got to meet them. Jack Cassidy, I met him first. And Jack Cassidy, he let me rehearse my group at the Airplane House when I was a teenager. Whenever the equipment was all out of the Airplane House, he said that I could practice in there. And he gave me a couple of bass cabinets, you know, and got me started. What's really funny is I played with so many of those people that I stood there on the sideline, you know, Googling, going like, wow, this is really cool. Music is really great. So I probably saw so much music. It was incredible. And then, so we had to go to sleep like at 9 o'clock. And my grandmother in 1965 would call the police and go, "Hey, my grandkids can't get to sleep." And then 3 years later, when my dad met Jerry, then she's feeding him chicken. You know what I mean? The same guys that she would call the police on. You know, so it was quite a transition, because if in 1965 it was still pretty segregated, even in San Francisco. And so the hippies came to, we lived, my grandfather worked for Mr. Lurie, who at the time owned the San Francisco Giants. We weren't supposed to live where we lived. There weren't any black families there. But Mr. Lurie went to the bank with my grandfather, said he needs a loan. And of course he got the loan. And we were one of about three black families that lived in the Haight-Ashbury. The rest were Jew. It was a very upscale Jewish, Irish Catholic neighborhood. And, you know, it was quiet. It was peaceful. You go to the store, sign for your groceries, and then your grandparents pay on the next weekend. You know, I knew everybody, you know. And so when the hippies came there, it was quite a change, you know, because.
Didn't it also go the other way? I remember when Bill Graham got the first Fillmore, that was in a really black neighborhood. And a lot of people were saying that Bill wasn't able to get the Fillmore.
I'll tell you what happened. So the Fillmore happened because that's where the blacks lived. The blacks lived where they worked in the shipyard. They all lived in the Fillmore district. That's where all the black people lived. So it was called too, because you couldn't live west of Masonic, which went from where the Panhandle was all the way to the beach. And you couldn't play music south of Van Ness. So at being black. So all the blacks went to the same hotel. That's why I met so many people. They all stayed at Sam Wong's hotel. In the Broadway district, and then my dad played at Jackson Sutter, which was right on Sutter and Fillmore, which was right around the corner from where Winterland was. So all the blacks played at the same clubs. You know what I mean? And that was the first place that where my dad played. I can't remember the name of the club, but where my dad played was the first place that blacks and whites could go to the same club and play. This is when he was playing jazz in the United States. Like, we played at you could work at the Cotton Club in New York, but you couldn't go there and just hang out. So on Monday nights, they had this music there, and blacks and whites could sit at the same table, you know, and go there. And it was the first place. A lot of people that have told me these stories. It's incredible.
So you'd have to play it. If you're playing north of Van Ness, that means it was basically all the places in the Tenderloin, like Great American Music Hall and all the theater district stuff, huh?
But this was pre that. So the union had it. The blacks couldn't play south of Van Ness, which is where all the hotels were. So all the hotel gigs.
Right.
Right. You know what I'm saying? All the good gigs. So, but they developed the Fillmore into such a mecca that everybody wanted to come there. That's why Bill Graham came there. And turned Winterland. I was sad when he did it, because I used to see the ice follies there every year. But I was happy. Little did I know when that was ending, you know, that would be part of my career, going to Winterland. I mean, I was there for the last days when the Grateful Dead stopped playing in the 70s. And then when the band did the last waltz, I saw Stevie Wonder open for the Rolling Stones. And like, I knew all the people. They just told me, I knew all the security guys. So, because I went there with my dad and Jerry. And so, so I could get into all these places. And they just said, "Tony, don't drink or get us in trouble." I said, "Oh, I'm cool. I'm cool."
Let me ask you.
Yes.
This is all great, but what was it like growing up, you know, with your father and with all of these amazing musicians, Jerry Garcia, and the guys in the Airplane, all of them. And, you know, I mean, and you're a young kid running around the house and they're all there. What, tell us about that.
Well, I didn't know that they were famous. I had no idea. I mean, my dad's first band, he had Johnny Mathis singing, you know?
Wow.
And so, I remember one time when Dionne Warwick came to our house, and I charged my friends $1 to come look at her. And I go, "Hey, you're that lady that sings, Do You Know the Way to San Jose?" And she said, "Yes." Her husband, Bill Eden, was playing drums with my dad, you know? And you know, at this jazz club. So yes, I knew that it was special because we got to do so many special things. I mean, so when the Philadelphia Warriors moved from Philly to San Francisco, so my dad met Wilt Chamberlain. So he had a record company with Wilt Chamberlain. So I hung out with Wilt Chamberlain. I cleaned his house for $5 a week. Oh. You know what I mean? And he would like the shortest girls. He would leave his car at our house when he went on road trips. He had a Bentley. You know what I mean? So he left that at our house. But I would clean up his house every Saturday for $5. I knew Wilt was famous because we would go to the Warriors games and we'd go to the Civic Auditorium and watch the Warriors play. And I would play pickup games with my dad. Me and my dad beat Wilt and my brother. You know, I don't know if Wilt let us or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was great. I mean, he was a super nice guy. And he later in life, when I lived in Los Angeles, he did me a solid. So when my parents split up, moved to LA, so all the friends, I told them, yeah, I know Wilt Chamberlain, you know, blah, blah, blah. They were like, okay, you take us to a Laker game and so they had this kids day. I was in junior high school. They had this kids day. He said, Tony, hook us up. So I said, yeah, let's go. And, you know, I never called Wilt and asked him, you know, but we had so much fun there. They didn't trip. When we were walking away from the place, nobody said, you know, Tony, you didn't introduce us to Wilt. So unbeknownst to me, we're walking across the parking lot. I hear this, Tony, because Wilt stuttered. I hear, Tony, Tony and Molly. He yelled for me and my brother, right? And he said, Tony. And so he pulled his Bentley up. He said, how you guys doing? You want to ride home? And we said, we're with our friends. So we're just going to take the bus. He said, tell your mom to make me a pie. I'll come by Wednesday and get it. You know what I mean? So when he came by Wednesday and got the pie, you know, he asked me, he said, do you want to be a ball boy sometime? I was like, yes. So, you know, I had to see some Laker games and meet Jerry West, Elgin Baylor. You know, I saw those guys. I saw Jerry West make that 63-footer when they lost to the Knicks because Dave DeBuscher hit a shot from the corner and they lost to the Knicks. But to hang out with Wilt was like incredible. You know what I'm saying? It's like Wilt Chamberlain. And for him to come across the parking lot and notice me by my big fat head, you know, I had kudos at school. I went to junior high school with Warren Moon, the quarterback, and who else went to my junior high? Sure. Oh, Marcus Johnson, who played on the Milwaukee Bucks.
Sure.
So I'm seeing some talented guys. But get back to your question, I was always around some talented music, you know what I mean? Some really great music, no matter where I went. My dad played with the Billy Williams Review, and they had those guys who did the with Shirley Temple show. That did those. He had those two twins were in that group, and you know, I met so many musicians that it was incredible. I would go on Saturdays. The lady who lived in front of me, she let the Crusaders rehearse at their house, so I would see that. So let's go back to San Francisco. So I would come visit my dad, and I would get to see so much music. You know, I didn't realize I'm hanging out at Mike Bloomfield's house, and like I found his pill stash in this tent that we would play in. So I carry these pills in to my dad. I go, "Hey, Dad, I found these in the tent." He's going, "What are you doing?" You know what I'm saying? So I mean, hanging around Bloomfield. Butterfield and Nick Gravanitis introduced my dad to that whole scene because I later did a session a few years ago with Gravanitis, and Gravanitis said he came from Chicago with Butterfield to San Francisco to fit in, but they're the ones who introduced my dad into that whole scene. And Gravanitis said everybody loved the way my dad played organ, so they kept him. And then at that time they was playing, Jerry was playing at the Matrix with Howard Wells.
Yeah.
And it was Howard Wells, John Kahn. Yeah. John Kahn, Bill Vitt, and my dad. And then so we would go to the Matrix because they had pillows for us to lie on. You know, we're just kids. And my dad liked to keep us around. And so what was really cool is that so when my dad met Jerry, then the business, Bill Vitt told me this, the business got more serious. And so my dad never played in the Jerry Garcia Band. That was after, it was called Merle Saunders right. and Jerry Garcia.
Right.
For those 70 to 73. And I mean, for us, we're these little black kids, you know, listen to Motown. And then all of a sudden we had this other music to listen to. I always thought it was cool because I loved the way John Conn played bass. And I imitated him and I could play every bass line. So,
but at that point, you were still a keyboard player, weren't you? Like you were still...
At 70 to 73, I was a keyboard player. Yes.
And you were getting taught by Herbie Hancock and Sly Stone, huh?
Well, I had a show on Sly Stone's. So Sylvester Stewart, Sly, he came to my house, to my dad, to get advice. You know what I mean? Because his career, he was a disc jockey, and all of a sudden Sly and the Family Stone start getting famous. So he would come to my dad. My dad was like the older guru. It's kind of like I am right now. I'm the free lawyer for everybody. You know, I said, well, Tony, should we do this or should we do that? You know, so my dad would advise Sylvester, and he saw me playing piano. He took an interest in me, and because I did I had an hour show on his show, and he bought me a B3 for my birthday, wow. my 10th birthday.
Oh,
and then George Benson came to talk to my dad before he did that record Weekend in L.A. He said, Merle, should I sing? And my dad going, yeah, you sing like an angel. He says, but what are the jazz guys going to think about my playing? I'm a jazz guy. And so he said, my dad said, it's okay. You sing really great and you play really great. Don't worry about it. And the next, within the next couple of months, he did that record Weekend in L.A., yep. which launched his career from playing, making $5,000 or $6,000 a night to playing arenas. And so that kind of stuff was happening to me all the time. So my dad was best friends with Jimmy Smith.
Which is insane because like Jimmy Smith is one of my all-time favorite piano players. Like, I don't think there's anyone that plays an electric piano better than Jimmy Smith. And Jimmy Smith Trio, like for me when I was young, was the thing that completely and totally changed my life as far as jazz, where I'm like, all right, this is a whole nother level.
I moved his organ every time he came to San Francisco. He's also a karate expert. And I'm standing on the corner of 57th and 7th Avenue in New York one day, and he comes, and I feel somebody kick me in my head. And it was Jimmy Smith. He said, I told you to always be on guard. Be ready. You know what I mean? But so I met George Duke when I was really young. The guy who owned the place where he would play at let me go in and sit behind everybody and said, Tony, don't make a peep, but you can watch this. So I saw George Duke play, Al Jarreau. My dad played. He played Jackson Sutter 6 nights a week. Then he had a Sunday jam session that everybody who was in town would come to. Miles, I have pictures with him playing with Miles, Lionel Hampton. You know, it was like a who's who of music people.
Chuck Rainey as well, huh?
Chuck Rainey was my dad's best friend, yeah, from when he moved to New York. And so Chuck Rainey was at my house, and he showed me how to play the Sanford and Son lick that he played on Sanford and Son. And the first time I saw Chuck Rainey play, he was playing with Quincy Jones, and it was him playing electric, Ray Brown playing the upright. You know, I'm going like, you know, it's like, and I knew who these guys were. But let me go back to when I was still playing keyboards. When my dad would go on the road with Jerry, I took out his truck and his B3 to play little high school gigs. And if he knows now, he'd probably come down from heaven and pop me upside my head. And my grandmother would say, does your dad know you're using the van? I'm going like, yeah. But then it's between us. Let's keep it low. Keep it on the low. He doesn't want me using it that much. In fact, there are people from my high school that come to my gigs now, and they go, Tony, when'd you switch to bass? And I go like when I was in the 9th grade, 10th grade, and they'll go like, we didn't know. So when I started picking up John, my dad would take me to John Conn's house. I'd sit there and learn stuff, and you know, and then I would listen to him play the gigs with him and my dad and Jerry. And I could play because I had the piano in me. I knew what the notes were, right? So after I start getting good, this is maybe 6 months into the thing, John Conn would say, well, why don't you come up and play the last song with Merle and Jerry? So I would come up and play the last song. So this one time we were on the way to a gig and my dad goes, hey, bring your bass. And I'm going, why I gotta bring my bass? I could just play John Conn's bass. And so Tom Fogerty from Creedence. So, okay, back up a little bit too for that.
Fogerty,
the Gollywogs rehearsed at Fantasy Records. When my dad was signed to Fantasy Records, they worked. The Gollywogs worked in the mailroom. the Gollywogs turned into Creedence Clearwater Revival. And I knew them from that. You know what I mean? So when Tom saw I was getting good at bass, he gave me a Fender pre-CBS bass. And so, you know, I went and got that and played my first gig with Dad and Jerry. Steve Peck, Big Steve, he told me about 2 months ago that they were all nervous because they didn't know that I could play. They didn't even, because before, Steve gave us $100 to move the organ on so he didn't have to come to San Francisco and pick up my dad's organ, right? And so I was just a roadie. So when my dad said, Tony's going to play, they all was like, huh? And they was all looking, it was like they were looking around a corner. And then they said, okay, here we go. Jerry didn't know I could play. No, Bill Vitt didn't know I could play. John Kahn was away playing with, I forget the name of the group, Brewer and Shipley. Him and Bill Vitt were gone playing with Brewer and Shipley because they had just done a record with them. So they were gone for 2 weeks. So my dad on the way, I was driving to play at the end of the beginning, which is about 45 minutes from San Francisco in Cotati, California. You know, halfway there, he goes, Tony, guess what? John's not there today. You're playing the whole gig. I go, what? I'm going like, what? He goes, just stand by my left hand. And then if you don't know the chords, I'll tell you the chords. So it's like, okay. And so I stood by him.
And that's 1974, like June of 74, somewhere around there?
I was 74, yes. I was 18 years old. And so I got through that gig. But after the first break, Jerry and my dad were like going high-fiving. It's going, Merle, Tony can play really good. We don't have to get subs anymore when John goes. We could just use Tony. And Parrish gave me like an amp, you know, gave me my equipment, you know, and he was really proud that I was good. And he said, but you're not a roadie no more. Now you're a musician. So he cut me off from getting my $100, you know what I'm saying? And I only could get paid from gigs. But, you know, I wasn't mad at it because I just kept getting better and better. And that's all I wanted to do. So playing my first gig, yes, I was nervous. You know, but I remembered every bass line. I didn't add any fills. I know I played everything just like John Kahn, you know, because I hadn't got my own identity yet. And so, you know, it was great. And, you know, girls like me, I was like, girls didn't like, because before I was always with my dad, never really had, you know, a weekend in high school when girls would go to the parties, you know, they would meet somebody else. They talked to me during the week, but on the weekend I had to go with my dad to gigs and he was breaking me in learning how to play bass. So I had no social life on the weekends, but then they found out I could play music and it was cool. You know, that's why I have a son. My son was born. My son's mother hung out around my dad and Jerry before I did. You know, she went to all the gigs. She went to all the Grateful Dead gigs. She introduced me to the Grateful Dead. You know what I'm saying? So I didn't know anything, but through her, she was a great girl. Her name's Leslie. We're still friends. You know what I mean? We're still best. We're still friends. We have sons. We have a son together. Her daughter claims me as a father because on Facebook, I'm more entertaining than her real dad. Her dad is only a lawyer who represented me for 30 years.
Hey, lawyers. Whoa.
You know what I'm saying? And so, yeah. She's blonde hair and blue eyes, right? But she claims me as a dad, right? And so she'll go to places and people are better. Tony Saunders ain't your dad. He's too black to be your dad. And she goes, call him and ask him.
Hey, Tony, let me ask you this. Tell me what it'd be like, you know, a night at your father's house, you guys were hanging out and Jerry comes over. You know, what happens that night? Are they hanging out? Are they getting stoned? Are they playing music? Are they telling you stories? What's happening?
We probably go downstairs. We probably smoke a fatty and then go downstairs and play music. Because Jerry was always learning from my dad the jazz stuff. And he gave me a book for Christmas one time, Thesaurus' Book of Scales, which has every scale that you could play mathematically. Some of the scales you can't play because you don't have enough fingers. So it would definitely be really cool, because they had their own world. My dad and Jerry loved each other a lot. And my dad, he was hurt when the group split up, but he was, he always still called on Jerry and Jerry still called on him, you know what I mean? To do separate projects. So they kept working until until Jerry passed.
Yeah, I mean, they did stuff, I mean, for years after the original Garcia Merle combination, but they did Legion of Mary together, they did Reconstruction together, they did Rainforest Benefit stuff.
They did the Reconstruction first, then Legion of Mary, and then the Rainforest CD, which was phenomenal.
Yeah, in 88.
And then I was there after Jerry had the brain theme, when he had the coma theme. And then I saw him basically learn the guitar. Because what I'll tell you, too, is after that, the Grateful Dead didn't play really long songs anymore because Jerry couldn't remember. He was good for about 8-9 minutes, but that was the most. You know what I mean? So they didn't put themselves in a situation. You notice Touch of Grey happened when they started playing again. And, you know, and then they started doing more concise music. You know, the songs all had endings instead of them playing them 40-minute jams, they would only be 10 minutes, you know, at the most. But they really only were like 5-6 minutes. And Jerry, he would always be into learning music. So what really made me learn about Jerry's love for my dad was, so my dad created a group called Aunt Monk. And we would play every Monday night at the Sand Dunes, this club in San Francisco, out by the beach. And Jerry would show up, no Steve Parrish, no, just by himself, because he knew we were playing, carrying his amp in and his guitar. You know what I mean? And he said, "Hey Merle, I just want to come play, learn some different tunes." As everything they played in Reconstruction and Legion of Mary, Jerry already knew because he played with my dad with Aunt Monk. We would play Stanley Clark stuff, Weather Report stuff. You know, we would play all this fusion stuff, and Jerry loved it. You know what I mean? He loved it because he would go. One time we played Stanley Clark's song Lopsy Lou, which goes like hella chords, and it's hella fusion-y. Jerry goes, that don't work. He said, "Hey, you know what? I got to come over, Merle, and we got to figure that one out." So he did, came over to our house after the gig. They figured it out. The next week when he played it, he was perfect, you know. And it led to me one time when I had to stand over by Jerry instead of my normal safety zone by my dad's left hand. You know, they played this song, Pennies from Heaven. I did not know it at all. And it's on YouTube somewhere, and with me screwing up the whole song. And I was so embarrassed after that. I said, "Jerry, I'm sorry. I didn't know that song." And he said, "Don't worry about it. It's just a fucking song. Play the next one. I know you know the next one." And I did. And I killed the next one. And, you know, so it was a combination. Those groups evolved because when I started getting better, I'm not saying this, but John wanted to do different things, you know, because I started getting better. And then instead of one song, people would go, "Hey, is Tony here tonight, John?" And I'm like, I know that rubbed him the wrong way. You know, I know it. I know it.
When that fusion stuff was big, I mean, that was a big influence on you as well. Like Alfonso Johnson from Weather Report was a big influence on your playing, huh?
Yeah, Alfonso Johnson was ridiculous. Cucumber Slumber, you know, that was the mess. You know, I later got to meet the guys who I loved playing, listen to when I was young. I loved listening to Jack. I got to play. There's on YouTube, there's a thing with me and Jack Cassidy playing Imagine, just the two basses. And I introduced him. I said, "This is my teacher. This is the teacher and the student." And you know, it was Jack the one time. So when Bob Steeler played in High Tuna, I was Bob Steeler's best friend. We would go downstairs in his house and we'd play for hours, right? So when Yorman would get mad at Jack, he would call up Bob and say, "Hey, is Tony around? Can we play some? Can you guys come over here and play?" So I'll get to go play with High Tuna. Yorman used to come to my gigs too and hang out.
Wow.
And then so Jack, I was like Marta's little kid when I was Yorman's first wife. I would be at all their sessions. Hey, and if you listen to, I think it's Funky Number 9 or something like that on Hot Tuna record, listen to that bass part. He stole it from me. Jack stole it from me.
One of my favorite Imagines of all time was actually your dad and Jerry at Pacific High Studios, I think in 1973 when they played the instrumental version together. Were you there for that?
Yeah. I went to every gig with my dad. It was free, get to hang out, smoke weed, listen to music. You know, that's a good thing when you're a kid.
Yeah, I think that was like a K-Fog thing, right? I think they played it for
K-Fog thing. Yep, and it was always like a really nice place and different people. You know, I'd meet all these really I would wonder why these beautiful women didn't look at me. It's because I was 14 years old. 15, 16 years old. But I would see these gorgeous women, and, you know, they would be like, why are you looking at me, little kid? You know.
So, Dan, why don't we fire up a little bit of Tony playing with Garcia? I think the next one we've got lined up is a cover of Marvin Gaye's What's Going On from the Keystone Theater in Berkeley, California, on January 22nd, 1975.
Yep. Thank God John was gone. That was cool. It's funny. There's the What's Going On. I think All Blues is on there that I know that I'm on. And then I'll tell you some I like how you interrupt and ask me questions because it just triggers more stories, you know. And Jerry also, for a while I lived in Inverness with this girl, beautiful woman. And she walked up to me at the gig and said, "I want to take you home." And she was, I'd never seen a woman that beautiful. Like I was just a baby, but she was 35. And I learned how I wanted to be later in life living with her. But Jerry lived on a couple of ridges over. So I was walking by his car one day and I saw his camel. So I took a couple of his camels and spoke to him. And when we got to the gig, he looked at me and he said, "Tony, why'd you take my cigarettes?" I reached in my pocket and I had a pack. I said, "I'm sorry, man, I was up on the ridge. And I saw your car, and I took a couple cigarettes. Don't worry, I'm replacing them right now. Here's a couple packs." He said, "Well, thank you. You're so nice for replacing them." You know, so it was good. You know, you just don't realize that, you know, Uncle Jerry was really famous, and that, you know, those people came out to see him every night. You know, and they just the people, like, they believe he's such an icon. They still come to see people play his music. You know what I mean? And it's like, you know, what a guy. What I will say is that what I learned from him is that keep learning music, because that's all he did. I think if he was alive today, he'd be a little bummed at all the copy groups that copy him, because what if he was having a bad night and you think that show was great and you're playing everything from that show that he did? But he was always a learner. He was always thinking about what can I learn to make myself better. And I really appreciated that about him.
So one of the things I'm going to say on this is, like, the reason I love Garcia, and I think Larry will say the same thing, is that we learned about so many other musicians that I would have never otherwise known about if it wasn't for Garcia. Like, the stuff that you guys were playing and the stuff that, you know, your dad and Jerry were playing, those were all, you know, for the most part, covers of other people that, you know, that I would have never heard of. Like, for instance, like, the next song we're going to play that you're on is Expressway. I would have never heard of Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, and I would have never heard of the Soul Survivors if it wasn't for for Garcia. So the stuff that he turned me on to, not just in in gospel music, and not just in like funk that he was doing, but even the Grateful Dead was largely a cover band. Like, sure, I would have discovered Dylan, but I wouldn't have discovered Howlin' Wolf at such a young age if it wasn't for Garcia. You know,
right. Although every New Year's they have somebody great playing with them. Like Wynton Marsalis, the Neville Brothers. You know what I'm saying? Those shows are like epic. And what's really funny now is, like, Bobby's an expert on everything, but he knows his facts. But the thing I'm gonna tell you about him, he knows his facts. He'll go, "Well, Tony, back in 1957, this guy did this," and he knows his facts because I played on Willie Dixon. I played on Willie Dixon's record that his daughter did. And he's going, "Well, you know, Willie Dixon, Bobby told me all the facts about him." You know what I mean? And
Little Red Rooster.
Yeah. And what a thing to play. You know, what a history to have. You know what I mean? If you listen to Weir's guitar parts in The Grateful Dead from back in the day, they're intricate. Because he was like accenting what he felt from Jerry and Phil. And sometimes it's not the easiest stuff. You know, or the stuff, if you really want to hear some great Bob Weir, listen to when Pigpen was in the Grateful Dead, and listen to what he played opposite Pigpen. That, it's like some incredible stuff. Those are some of my favorite shows, you know, with Pigpen. And of course, the last night of the Grateful Dead at Winterland, that was incredible. I was there all three nights, and it was just incredible.
Did you ever get to play bass with Phil Lesh?
No, he won't. He won't. In fact, when I was at his club, I want to, and he respects me as a player. And he's going, a Terrapin Station opened, and he was shaking everybody's hand. That was his thing. So he walks down the line, and he goes, wait a minute, Tony? I said, yeah. He says, why did you just come ask me? Could you come in? I said, it's cool. I can afford $5. It's cool. And I didn't really want to ask a favor. Maybe I'll ask it for another show. But I didn't need a show. I didn't need a favor. I just wanted to be like everybody else and go in the show. And he goes, you know, then he shakes everybody's hand. He goes inside, gets one of his kids to come out and get me. He says, these kids, they come out. Where's Tony Saunders? And these girls are all going, I'm with him. And I'm going, no, you're not. You kicked me. You didn't want to talk to me. You know what I mean? So when I got in there, he goes, Tony, why are you here? You're a jazz guy. Why are you here? I said, I love the way you play. And he goes, for real? I said, yeah, I do. And that was the first interaction that we had about that. I'm still working on him to get to do it in public. I'm still working on him because I've done it with Jack. He's the last one, you know, while he's alive, I want to get to that I haven't played with from the Grateful Dead. I played with everybody else except Pigpen and him. And you know, that would be awesome to me. That would be like the it would close my door on that one. But I play with everybody else.
So as I said, the next thing we're going to listen to is Expressway to Your Heart, which is one of the most fun, funky songs you guys played in the 1970s. I love the bass line on this tune. I love that this bow, 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 right? It's such a fun, playful tune. I got to think as a 17 or 18-year-old kid, you had to love playing that song.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was like that taught me more music. You know what I mean? Because I knew the R&B stuff. You know, I knew about that because, you know, I grew up listening to it. But now I'm meeting music that crossed over. You know what I'm saying? Music that crossed over. Bigger genre. So when we play that song now in Keystone Revisited, people hum the bass line just like you did. And when I add something extra, they go, we heard that part that you added to Expressway, because it just goes boom, boom.
And then it segues into your dad's part. You know, your dad would come in with the keys heavy right after that part. Yeah. And they're like, wah! Yeah. It's such a – maybe we should just listen to a quick bit of that, Dan. We'll talk about it on the other side.
Okay, yeah, it's a great song.
Tony, it's so much fun. Obviously, I've heard a handful of people do it, but the only reason I ever knew about that song was because of, like, you know, 1974 through 76 Garcia iterations, whether it was, you know, with your dad or whether it was Legion of Mary. You know, those were the ones that you know, Expressway.
And they played a song called Motherlode. If you could, it's a song called When I Die. It was by Motherlode, this group from Canada that my dad and Jerry liked. It was like pretty awesome. And, you know, it was, for me, like I have no prejudice whatsoever towards anybody. I am glad that I've been turned on to all this music. You know what I mean? Not that many people would think I'm lying if I said I've been around the Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, Crosby, Stills and Nash, you know, Sly Stone. You know, they think that I'm like a guy that's like bragging. But I'm not. You know, it was a great thing. And I got to play with Butterfield. Butterfield bought, at the end of one of my dad's tours, he bought me back to Woodstock. I stayed at the barn. And so while I was there, I got to play with John Sebastian, Leon Russell, and his wife, Mary McCreary, Butterfield. I stayed upstairs and I got to watch Max Roach play at the Joyous Lake. You know, I mean, it's like
jazz legends.
You know, yeah. And then I got to meet Al Grossman. You know what I mean? And then these roadies, this one roadie that I worked with when I was 12 years old lived there. He worked for Butterfield.
How does Max Roach get together with Park Butterfield and John Sebastian? I mean, just Sebastian and Butterfield make sense together, but Max Roach throwing that into the mix.
No, Max Roach was playing his own stuff. We were just watching him. But I learned, he taught me, Max Roach showed how the hi-hat could just play a song. And I was going like, wow.
He's one of the best jazz trap drummers I've ever seen.
Ever.
Yeah.
Ever. Yeah. Ever. You know what I mean? Amazing. What can you say?
Hey, so let me ask you a different question. We've talked about a lot of the guys that came before you, but you know, in the Bay Area, there's a lot of bass players that came after you. Like Les Claypool and Charlie Hunter would be two that would come to mind. I mean, Charlie sort of being a fusion guy also and doing a lot of stuff with jazz. Did you like?
We played at the same. We played Charlie Hunter and I played at the same club, the Paradise Lounge, forever. He would be playing upstairs, I would be playing downstairs, or vice versa. And so I saw him develop that whole thing. And my friend played drums with him.
Is that Jay Lane?
Yeah, yeah. And it was like, you know, Les Claypool was ridiculously. I also, in that same time period, Metallica came. That bass player, Brett, all of a sudden he got real good. It was really funny because the guy in Metallica would play in all of these funk bands, right? And then the next thing I know, Brad Russell, I think his name, and then I can't remember, that might not be the right name, but anyway, the guy he was the guy in Metallica that played bass, he sang, he was in like a bunch of funk groups. And when I found out he was the pretty boy singing Metallica, I was like, whoa, you know, I couldn't believe it. And just so many.
Was it Cliff Burton? Is that right?
Yeah.
But so, like, I look at Les Claypool, and I think Les is probably one of the most innovative bass players of all time. But I look at a lot of the stuff that you were doing before he got big, and I look at a lot of the stuff that, like, you know, when I watch you do bass solos now, and how innovative your bass playing is, and it's not like you said you're a huge like devotee of John Kahn, but John Kahn was a very straightforward bass player, and even when he did his solos on like Russian Lullaby and his, you know, solos on some other tunes, they were very understated. They never really got super super funky the way that your bass playing is. Do you think someone like Les, you know, took a lot from you?
Yeah. It was like, but you have to remember, I idolized John Kahn to the T. So I could probably play you Russian Lullaby like note for note. But I had this other crazy side in me that, you know, I saw Jimi Hendrix play when I was a kid. You know what I'm saying? So I want to treat the bass like, you know, I want to treat the bass like a guitar. So that's why you get the funk stuff mixed up, but then I want to be melodic and I want to tell stories. So, you know, I want to try to mix it all in. You know, playing the stuff that I do now with the smooth jazz stuff, it's cool. But really, I have the most fun playing at Keystone Revisited because we play, you know, all of these tunes. And I play solo in that band and I can play whatever now because my dad's not telling me what to do. but it's like, you know, expressing yourself, you know, and that's what I learned the most from all of those guys, from John Kahn, from Jerry, is that they express themselves. I mean, if you listen to like Get a Dead song and listen to it through the different periods and listen to what Jerry played, that's what I listen to. And some of the stuff, like he plays it different on the different guitars. You know what I mean? Sometimes when he's playing the Travis Bean, listen to that stuff. It's like totally different than anything he's played. Or when he got Tiger. You know what I mean? It's like it's playing. I remember seeing him play those guitars when he first got them, and he was like, you know, he's a bad dude. You know what I mean? And to be surrounded by all of that creativity makes who I am, because I'm always reaching for it. You know what I mean? Alfonso Johnson once told me, he said, Tony, everybody has its place. There's only going to be so many virtuosos. There's going to be so many really good people. Then there's going to be some teachers. There's going to be some innovators. You know, he explained to me, and I was like, oh, wow, I never thought that. And then so I teach now. I have some great students, you know, but I also love to go out and play. I'll never lose that. Because my dad toured until he passed away, You know, he was still, I couldn't. In fact, the reason why I didn't play with him, I started out with him in the Rainforest Band, but it was like, he was like touring all the time. He never went home. You know what I mean? I was like, oh, dude, I got to go home. And then, so, you know, I played with other people and stuff, but that was, you know, what a conniption of musicians that I've been able to come across.
So what other contemporary guys do you love? I mean, like, the bass and expression and funk like that. There's, like, Victor Wooten, someone that you love on bass these days? Or
who
else is out there?
Who doesn't?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But who's just crushing it right now?
Victor Wooten, Stanley Clark Distiller, Ralph Armstrong on upright. He plays upright on upright. You know, I used to love the guy that played in, not the Wolf Brothers, the guy that passed away. That was in Bob's group before.
Yeah, Wasserman.
Bob Wasserman. Yeah, I used to love him. I loved him and everything he did. He was like awesome. So my thing is so I got that stand up stuff in me, but I'm a play it on electric bass and make you feel it like my electric bass. You know what I'm saying? So I could play the cute melodies, but I also could tear up the bass. You know what I mean? So don't think that I'll play Purple Haze at a jazz gig, and they won't even know what I'm doing, except for my deadheads who know that, hey, Tony's playing Purple Haze here with this jazz stuff. Nobody knows that he's playing Hendrix stuff. You know what I mean? So I mix all of that stuff in. I listen to Les Claypool so that I could get charged up. You know, I listen to Brian Bromberg, who plays electric bass and upright, and he plays guitar and drums. But I listen to him because he's like so good, and his rhythm thing is like, it's like he plays paradiddles on the bass, you know. So I'm getting into that, learning how he does that, you know. And I like anybody who's good. I have a guy that I'm working with right now, and he plays bass a little bit like Lesh. And I'm going, that's kind of Lesh-ish. And he's going, I thought I sounded more like Jack Cassidy. And I said, nah, that ain't Jack Cassidy. That's Lesh. One thing I want to tell you about Jack hadn't seen me play in about 10 years, and he saw me play at a NAMM show, and a tear came down his face because he says, I can't believe how good you've gotten, Tony. And he walks over to the Gibson booth and gives me one of his signature basses. You know what I mean? And then I'm crying. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
I'm going, thank you so much, man. It's like, wow, man.
Hey, Tony, I love all this music talking. We're going to get back to it in a minute, but given that this is the Deadhead Cannabis Show, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to please relate to us the story about how after your father died and you were cleaning up the house and you moved a piece of furniture and there behind it on the floor, you found Jerry Garcia's pipe. Okay.
So I didn't find it. My brother did. So when Jerry came there after he got out the hospital, he stayed in my brother's room. And, you know, they played every day for about 2 weeks because really, he really couldn't play. And I was going like, what happened? And he just said, my brains got scrambled. And then I forgot. And I was going like, wow. And so, yeah, he found his little whatever crack pipe or whatever you want to call it. Also, what was really funny is that whole week while he was at my dad's house, a black cat sat on his hood. For real. A black cat sat on the hood of his car. It's like, you know, come on. For real. And my dad was very gentle with him. You know, I know that my dad didn't know that that pipe was there or he would have taken it, you know. And plus two, I was working with him and John Kahn when he went on to work the last gigs that he did. I was working on a movie score and they would go in the back. I could say that they never did anything with me other than pot. Never did anything with me. So they would come out the back, him and John Kahn would say, Tony, so I'm writing this score for this movie. The movie was called Farmer and Chase. And they were going to submit a couple songs to it. And I was doing the music. So I'm working at John's house. They go in the back. They come out. Listen, let me hear what you did. And I said, they go, oh, yeah, yeah. It sounds great. And then they go back in the back. But John Kahn and as you know, Jerry were like inseparable with everything that they did. Unfortunately.
Yep.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Yep.
They're troublemakers. So when Jerry came out of his coma, it was basically your father and Carlos Santana that really taught him how to play music again, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I sat down there with him in my dad's studio and watched him play. And it was like, you'd be humbled if you were there that day. You know what I mean? You'd be humbled.
Was your father really patient with him at that time? Because all the stories I've read is that...
My dad was always patient. And Jerry gave him a... There's something on the internet when Jerry talks about that he'd always make time to play with my dad. When we did the Twilight Zone episode, Phil Lesh gave me the job to play bass because he only played on the opening theme and the closing theme. But he didn't have the time to come there every day to do the TV show. And we did it for 2.5 years. Jerry would come on Thursday. Me, Bob, and Brent were there every day with my dad. And that's how I got into sushi, because Bob would order sushi every day, and I started liking it after a while.
Hey, what was Brent like?
Brent was super nice. We were like kids. You know, we were like two kids because we would like be joking around and stuff. We would be like the kids, like messing with stuff on Front Street. You know what I mean? Until my dad needed us. And then he'd go, hey, where are you? But, you know, and there's a couple of Hate Street things where Brent's playing my dad's B3 and my dad's playing synthesizers. And if he didn't like him a lot, he wouldn't be playing a B3. You know what I mean? So sure. Brent was a nice, super nice guy. Great keyboard guy, too. And I love the way he sang, too. He was cool. He was cool. With me and him, we're like friends. We were like, we go, hey, did you see that girl like in the third row last night, Tony? Well, here she is.
he was the keyboard player when I started seeing the Dead in 82. So I missed all the earlier guys. Right. I loved Brent, but it was like, boy, I wish I could have seen Pigpen. But then 10 years later, my younger brothers are going and they're hearing Vince and they're, oh, we wish we could have heard Brent. Right. So everybody always wishes. And I loved Vince Welnick, too. I thought he did a great job.
He did do a great. I got to play with Vince, too. I was in one of his solo bands. And then he passed away, like right before we're getting ready to do this major tour.
So is that Missing Man Formation?
Yeah. Yeah. I would go up to his house and we played for hours, man. And he was cool. Man, he could play. And so that was around the time when Bruce Hornsby would be around too. And Bruce Hornsby would play a lot too with them. And Vince was that structured where he played like he could do like the Hornsby stuff. You know, and he had songs that were kind of like that Hornsby vibe, he had songs like that. It was I always liked to fit in with the different things, you know, and luckily I did.
Let me ask you a strange question. And that, how did your dad feel about Melvin Seals? Were they friends? Were they
I knew Melvin Seals from when I was 16. So I used to play sessions for Melvin Seals when he had a 4-track, right? And so we were always going on. I was always going on the road, and then Melvin would go like, "Oh, wow, I wish I could do that and go on the road." Then he got the gig with Elvin Bishop, and then he got to play with Dolly Parton, play with a bunch of people. And Melvin was a good gospel guy. Still is a good gospel guy.
Yeah. He's still one of my favorite B3 players. And it's like him with the B3 and a Leslie, it's no better.
Yeah. But he's more of a gospel guy. He's not really a jazz guy. He's not really a jazz player. He's not really a jazz guy. He can't.
He's a church organist.
He's a church organist. And if you listen to him play, and I love him dearly. Don't get me wrong. But it's different when you got a gospel guy playing this music. You know, they're going to stay pretty conformed to parts. And sometimes when we play someplace that JGB has just played, they'll say, hey, you guys don't play the same show every night. Because sometimes we see Melvin play the same show. I said, you know what? I haven't seen Melvin since because we're working all the time. I haven't seen him in a long time. But, you know, I know he's a great player. He's a great producer. He had a gospel record company called Secret Records. And I would play on all the records. You know, it was great. I remember when he met his wife, you know, and he would always want to be wild. So when they had a new convection of Jerry Garcia, after Reconstruction, they did Maria Muldaur, because of her with John Kahn, she suggested Melvin because they wanted to go a different direction.
And there was no animosity between your father when Jerry decided to go that direction instead of working with Burl still?
I mean... He was still. It was funny. They would be rehearsing on the other side of Front Street, and we'd be on the other side doing a Twilight Zone. I'm sure that my dad wanted to still be playing with Jerry because he loved him that much.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. He loved him that much. But, you know, my dad rolled with the punches. And because at first they used the guy from the Stones. What was his name?
Nicky Hopkins.
First they used Nicky Hopkins. And my dad was kind of bummed about that. But then, you know, when Jerry came and played with him away, he knew that Jerry still wanted to play with him. You know what I'm saying? So they did enough other stuff that he was cool. And I was really proud of my dad when he had his first sellout. I was with him. It was in Rochester, New York. And, you know, all of the Deadheads came out to see him. And it was great. It was great. It was great. And, you know, it was great. So I'm sure that the animosity wore off. You know what I mean? My dad and Melvin did a tour.
They did. You know what I mean? That's great.
Yeah, so it wasn't never any talked about animosity. Knowing both people, my dad was a jazz guy. Melvin's a gospel guy. Melvin, I played more church stuff with Melvin. I played on tons of records for him for church people. Melvin got that down. And he can do stuff that my dad couldn't do in gospel. My dad has jazz stuff down and could do jazz stuff that Melvin couldn't do. But they're both great players. You know, they're both great players. And Melvin, for him to keep this this thing going on for as long as he had, JGB, it's incredible. It's incredible. You know what I mean? It's incredible. But he sticks to the book. I know that because sometimes if he comes and sit, the last time I played with him at Great American Music Hall, he says, he was telling me a song that we were playing with Norton Buffalo. And he's going like, this goes like this, Tony, like this, because he wanted me to do this notes. You know what I'm saying? So I'm humble because I don't want to make mistakes. So I listen to him and I play the correct notes. You know, so I have utmost respect for Melvin. I wish that we would sometime get together and play, but he doesn't want to do that because he has certain specifications. In fact, the bass player that plays in JGB, what's his name?
I'm not sure he's got now.
Okay, he's had the same guy forever. But anyway, that guy, when I would go sit in on his gigs, he would go, "Oh, Tony, that's cool. Do something different." You know what I mean? And so we would hang out, and I'd go sit in on his arm. We played with this girl named – we both played with this girl named Kathy Cotton, and it needed to be me or him. And then he would come hang out with me, you know, which was really cool.
Hey, let me ask you a quick question about this, Tony. Do you keep up with any of the new jam bands, Fish, Widespread Panic, Goose, any of those guys?
I like Widespread Panic a lot. I love Trey Anastasia a lot. That's my favorite group, right? Trey is my favorite group. And I'm going to get to play with the big guy.
Dave Schools?
No, I played with him before because he plays with Bobby. He plays with Bobby a lot. When they used to do Weirds Here, I used to be all the time there, and they let me do my own Weirds Here. And Schools doesn't like me around that much. But that's another story. But I like him.
Yeah.
No, he doesn't have any animosity towards me. For real. I'm just making that up. For real. We're the best of friends. That was a Tony Fibb. I'm trying to think of the guy. Who's the guy who plays harmonica that sings?
John Popper.
So I'm getting ready to do some stuff with him in tribute to my dad and Trey. And, you know, that's going to be pretty awesome. And we're going to release. So you mentioned this earlier, Robert, about that Imagine track from the Lion's Share. So what I've done is we've taken that, we've broken it down, and we've added it so that we've made a new song out of it. So we took out all the melodies, but we left all their solos. You know what I mean? So we're going to have a track of Imagine come out with Jerry and my dad, Bill Vitt and John Kahn, with Tony Saunders playing the melody, and Scott Guberman and Danny Eisenberg playing additional organ, additional keyboards. The lead singer of David Ruffin Jr. singing it, and we didn't get in their way when they did their stuff. We let them do their stuff and it all comes naturally, except for I play the melody. You know, so of course I'm in tears the first time. And you'll have this, Dan, I have your email, so I'll send it to you. Just don't play it for anybody because it won't be out for another year, probably. Just don't play it. Yeah, sit on it. Listen to it, though. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. And if you have anything to say that can make it better, tell me, because I'll listen. Oh. That's for sure.
Yeah. I don't think Larry and I are qualified to do that, Tony.
Dan might be.
Yeah.
But it's a great track.
So hey, you were saying that your dad was a jazz guy, Melvin was a gospel guy. I've listened to your music, and I think you're kind of everything. You got a lot of funk in you. I was gonna play one more track before we get to some of your individual stuff you've done later. But on the funk side, we have a quick little bit of you playing Boogie on Reggae Woman, obviously a classic Stevie Wonder tune. And so if you don't mind, let's play a little bit of that. This is again.
Let's boogie.
Yeah, this is let's see if I remember the date on this one specifically, but.
July 22nd, 1974.
Thank you. Wow. Appreciate that. One of your earliest gigs with Jerry and Merle. So let's cue that up. Is one of those classic songs that so many people have covered. Obviously, Fish has made it really popular and introduced it to a whole new wave of youngsters out there.
Fish does it really good. I like Fish a lot. I also like, what's the group from Colorado that plays the Grateful Dead stuff like really good? And it's a lot. It's a big
the String Cheese Incident.
String Cheese Incident is one, but there's another group. Yeah. They're like an orchestra.
A Dark Star Orchestra.
Oh yeah, Motet.
Yeah, Dark Star Orchestra. I like them a lot. I like them a lot because they make me like relive the days I took acid. You know, I sit there and go like, wow. I remember I took acid that day and went to Stinson Beach and watched the water melt down the side of the mountain. You know, it was really pretty awesome.
I used to live right next door to Rob Eaton from Dark Star. Their bass player, Rob Eaton, was lived right down the street from me in Colorado for years. Yeah, those guys are great guys, man. What they do is such a unique thing.
Oh my God, it's so good. You know, it's so good. You know, and I'm glad that the Bobby sometimes plays with them and sits in. And I don't know if Phil's played with them, but I know Bobby has. I've seen videos of Bobby playing with them, and they're just like really good. String Cheese Incident is like impeccable. So I'm doing something right now with a girl that plays cello and a girl that plays upright and violin. That's going to be on my next album that I'm working on right now. And it's going to have cello, acoustic bass, violin, and me playing electric. And it's going to be just a great
song. What label are you on now?
I'm on Baja TSR Records.
Cool. And those guys are treating you well? They're giving you all the freedom you want to just create?
Yeah. They want me to make hit singles, though. I'm going, hit singles? I'm going like, you know, but wait a minute. I said, so.
Who do you think I am, my father?
I got.
Merle did on hit singles.
I've had like three or four hits. I've had three or four smashes. I'm cool with that. But you know what, though? To just say that, to say, hey, I need you to write me a hit. I'm going, but there, when they signed me, I was number two to their guy who's number one for a whole year. And so they signed me because of that. So don't forget that. You know what I'm saying? And we don't pick the song that's going to be a hit. I said, my most played song, we didn't predict that. We didn't pick that as a single. So it's like, anyway, but that's a whole nother hour.
So how do people find you and where your upcoming tours are? Do you want to plug a website? You want to plug anything else that you're doing right now?
TonySaunders.com.
There we go.
And please come to TonySaunders.com and you could get a hold of me. My phone number is even on there. If you want to talk to me, you can call me because I need to gig. You know what I'm saying? So you know, I'm not that elusive or not that famous where I have an agent. I have a couple of agents. But, you know, if you want to talk to me, some people, this guy called me up from New York. He wanted to hire me to work on this movie, right? And he called me like at 9 in the morning, right? He says, hello, I want to speak to Tony Saunders. I said, this is Tony Saunders. He says, no, the one that plays bass. I said, no, this is him. He says, why are you answering your phone? Why don't you have somebody do that? I said, well,
right.
The budget isn't in the budget yet. When I do get that, then you won't be able to talk to me.
I've had it the other way, Tony. I've had it the other way where I had Bernie Worrell call me one time and I got on the phone and I was like, you know, before Bernie passed, and he's like, it's Bernie Worrell. I'm like, bullshit. Who is this really? He's like, no, man, it's Bernie Worrell. I want to know if you want to manage a tour of mine coming up. And I had the same thing with Stephen Perkins from Jane's Addiction, where in both times I'm like, there's, you know, no, seriously, who is this really? Like, which one of my friends is fucking with me right now? But it's right, so funny. Right. So, like, you know, for you, it's the other side. You're like, no, this is really me. For me, it's always like, no, this can't be you.
Yeah. And so Mick Fleetwood called me up one time. He says, hey, Mike, this is Mick. I'm going like, Mick who? He says, Mick Fleetwood. I'm going like, no way. I said, hold on for a second. And I put the phone down. I was like, fucking A, Mick Fleetwood. You know what I'm saying? I can't believe it. And he wanted to write a song with me. And then I played with him a couple times over in Maui. You know, it's like, wow. You know, when these people call you, you know, like when I got to play with David Crosby, you know, that was incredible. I didn't even know a song that Crosby, Stills, and Nash did. I didn't know a song. He's going like, don't you know Wooden Ships?
Right. Come on, teach your children how Garcia in the beginning of it. You know, Garcia does the lead pedal steel on that.
I learned all of that, but I didn't know who he was. And then he wouldn't like me to play with other people after I started playing with him. And one time Stephen Stills asked me to play with him, and David Crosby was like, no, I discovered Tony.
He's mine.
But you know, some of my greatest music, I was with Tim Crosby when he got busted in Texas. You know, I was playing bass with him. You know, I was the unidentified black man who the police say stopped him from going in the dressing room. But I was just leaning up against the dressing room door because I didn't go in there to do whatever they did. I didn't go in there, right? And so I'm leaning against the door, half asleep. Cop hits me in my chest, and I punched him back because I didn't know I was asleep. And so I was asleep, and I hit him. If you get hit here in the chest and you're asleep, you're going to punch back. So in the next day in the paper, it was like I was the – it said an unidentified black man tried to stop a police officer from going in to arrest David. And, Crosby goes, Tony, you clocked him. His jaw was tacked up. And so I'm not proud of that because I have all the respect in the world for the police, you know, but it was just like, you know, in the wrong place at the wrong time. But David Crosby, I learned how to do a lot of music from him, and I learned how to fit in. The drummer that played with us at that time was Jay David, and he was the drummer in Dr. Hook. And he taught me how to play all the different – he taught me how to mix in what I do good with what goes well with the track. You know what I mean? He would have signals. If I was playing too funky for him, he'd hold up the white side of his hand and go, I need you to be a little whiter.
How can you be too funky for Dr. Hook? You know, I always think of Dr. Hook as being one of the funkiest guys out there.
If we were doing a session, playing on somebody's stuff. I think I played on Juice Newton stuff. He was going like, you know, need to lighten that up a little bit.
Juice Newton, Queen of Hearts, huh?
Yeah, Queen of Hearts. I played on one of her records. And one of my fun periods away from my dead type music, although it was really free, was when I played with Buffy St. Marie. And we played like all these Indian reservations. And on one day, we played at the end of The Longest Walk. In one day, I met Marlon Brando, Muhammad Ali, Stevie Wonder, Ralph Abernathy, Dick Gregory, Richie Havens, Floyd Westerman. I spent like an hour and a half. Marlon Brando's only like 5'4", 5'5". You know, I'm going like, he said, if you ever look at him on film, he's always off. He's never show how tall he is. He said he's always off. But it was amazing to talk to Marlon Brando for an hour. You know, that was
Richie
great.
Havens is like 7 feet tall. It's the total opposite.
Yeah, Richie Havens, super tall. Yeah. And the other guy, if you did you ever watch Barney Miller?
Of course.
So my dad's best friend was Walter Howitz, Max Gale.
That's one of my favorite bass lines as well, man. Talk about a great intro of a bass line.
Yeah. Yep, I know that one, definitely. My first bass line I ever played, my first bass line that I learned besides something John Kahn played was a staple singer. That was my first thing. I thought I was so cool. I would carry my bass to parties and go, hey, listen to me.
Tony, you are so cool.
I'm hanging. Hey, man, my life has not been boring. You know what I mean? I thank God. Thank God for having friends like you guys. You know, I never knew prejudice or anything like that because I grew up in California. So I didn't know that they say you're supposed to marry somebody with blonde hair and blue eyes, which I did the first time. And then they say they're supposed to marry somebody dark and handsome. Well, I say, well, I'm dark. You know what I mean?
So, one out of two ain't bad.
One out of two ain't bad. And so I didn't know till I was in Oklahoma one day that there was prejudice. And, you know, it was just, you know, I didn't know about that. You know what I'm saying? But, you know what I'm saying? We're born out of love. We're born out of making love. So, you know, so I'm into the love thing. And, you know, I'm always trying to, I say that at my gigs. And I just want to share love. My dad just shared love with me. I mean, he could have not taken me under his wing and, you know, taught me music and just let me be out there, you know, but he didn't, you know what I'm saying? But because of that, I mean, I've got to play with Dave Liebman, Pee Wee Ellis, you know what I mean? You know, I've got to play with some of these guys that are super good, you know, so my cousin played drums with Stanley Turrentine, Sonny Rollins. These guys would be at my aunt's house on Sunday eating chicken when they played at the Keystone, you know. So, you know, it's like wow. Vince Guaraldi, I love Vince Guaraldi because he was on Fantasy. The Peanuts stuff, that's what I had. So Peanuts was made at Fantasy Studio. So I had all of the cartoons of Charlie Brown, Vince Guaraldi. I was there for when he recorded live at Grace Cathedral.
Tony, I had one of the best nights of my life one night up in Humboldt County, high as can be on Molly, listening to Vince Guaraldi, just like with the whole house lit up, and just realizing just how insanely amazing that music is. And I mean, obviously, like substances, I'm sure helped, but just the music by itself, I only thought about it as like, you know, kids' cartoon music.
Yeah.
And here I'm in my late 20s, and all of a sudden hearing it in a whole new light and taking on an absolutely new appreciation for just how brilliant that guy was. So it's, yeah.
Hey, he was brilliant, man. He was brilliant. That stuff fit into the cartoons, and it was made for everybody.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was everybody. Everybody liked that music. You know, just like everybody likes the Grateful Dead. You go to a Grateful Dead show, you see so many generations. You know what I mean? And even the kids.
You know why I like it, Tony? Because I can go to the Grateful Dead show still, and I'm not even close to being the oldest guy in the joint.
Yeah, I can go there too, and it's like that thing. I love that group and the incarnations that are happening now. It's like, you know, you see so many people. And I like it that the young kids who are, you know, growing up with ear pods on, you know, they're starting to know, like, shows. And they're like going, oh
yeah.
I like 68.
My kids listen to all of it.
Yeah.
My kid's 7 years old. My son's seven. And he'll tell me which Shakedown Street's his favorite or which Fire in the Mountains is favorite. So it's still happening, man. This isn't going anywhere. As your father said to you, as I've said to my kid, you'll be listening to this for the rest of your life. You don't know that yet, but you'll be listening to this for the rest of your life. So we're raising them well, man. Tony, like, I don't want to cut this short. You've been so generous with your time, but we've had you for over an hour now. And, you know, you're welcome to come back on the show literally anytime, even if we tell the same story. Like,
have me back. So. Have me back. I'll send you. I'm going to send you this track of Imagine. Listen to that, and then you know, further down the line, have me back on, and maybe I'll get some
of
my Keystone guys with me. Scott Guberman. So my thing is, what I want to say to all the people that love the Grateful Dead: go out there and do your own music. Also, yes, copy them. Because they played some great music. But if you want to know what was in Jerry's heart, he would want you to play what's in your heart. Because that's what he did every night. And if he made a mistake, so be it. You know what I mean? So what? It's just music. You make a mistake. That's what it's there for. So I would encourage people that want to play like the thing that he played on Tiger in 1971 at at the
Fillmore East
at the Madison Square Garden at the Fillmore East on Madison Square Garden. You know,
Capitol.
Yeah, Capitol Theater. You know what I'm saying? So, hey, express yourself is what he would say. He would go like, "Why are you copying me? I was having a bad night that night."
You do a great imitation, by the way. I love that.
Hey, well, if you can imagine, you know, I sat there next to him, and I'm in awe of this whole situation going on. I'm like going like, wow, this is a trip, man. These same people are here like every night, you know, to watch these people play. I'm like going, wow, this is like crazy. Some of the same people. I hang out with some of the same people that I hung out with when I was 14.
That's amazing. That's like, wow. Incredible. These are great stories.
But hey, I think you guys have a great show. And you know, I'm glad that cannabis has gotten to such an elite level where now you don't have to guess if you're getting good weed. You know you're getting good weed.
Amen.
I know that, but you know, I know that now it's really good. You know, I'm cool. Like I say, I'm a frequent flyer, so I'll eat something to get on that plane so that I can sleep the whole way and wake up in another place where I got to play music.
I'm pretty sure at any time you can always call Big Steve for some Grizzly Peak joints or call Mickey Hart to get some little dog walkers. But, yeah, I'm pretty sure you're well taken care of just by the Grateful Dead community for all the weed you could ever smoke.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't want for anything. This musical appreciation for my dad's music, you know, it's like it's so overwhelming. My last story I'm going to leave you with. So we're playing a gig in Connecticut. This lady walks up to me with a bra that my dad has signed. And she's going like, "Can you sign the bra too?" I'm going like, "My dad already signed it. I'm cool. Besides, that was looking at that bra. That's from a long time ago. So, you know, just either wear it as a COVID mask or, you know, you don't need my signature on there. My dad's already signed it. You're cool. I'll sign one of my pictures and give it to you, but I can't sign the bra because my dad already signed it. Okay. What else you guys did? I'm cool with. I'm glad you came to the show. Thanks for the opportunity, but no thanks.
You gotta know.
But I've gotten so many great things from people giving me stuff that my dad has signed. And it always brings a tear to my eye when I see something he wrote to people a long time ago. It's cool. It's very cool. This family is like the Grateful Dead took care of their entire family. You know what I mean? So it's great to share with it because it's in me. People ask me, how could I be a twirler and play jazz? I say, because it's in me. It's in me. I went to Grateful Dead shows. I grew up listening to this music.
You know how to twirl. I love it. That's great.
I know how to twirl. Yeah. But I thank you guys for having me on, and it's pretty awesome. You guys are really cool.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
Thank you so much.
So before we finish up today, before we say our goodbyes, we are going to end with some of Tony's more recent music as he plays Rock Steady, which I believe was a Michael Jackson cover, at the end of the show. And from, you know, my side of it, Tony, thank you so much for joining us today, and much love to you and your entire family, to the whole Saunders family, for just giving me endless, endless hours of great music to listen to for the last 35 or 40 years of my life. And I can't even tell you how appreciative I am for what you've contributed to my life and my friends' lives in just terms of just pumping out amazing, amazing music for all these years. Keep doing what you're doing, man.
I will.
I'm a huge fan, and I'm so thrilled to have you on today. So thanks for the stories and for your time.
Okay.
And so Rob Hunt signing off from Southern California.
And Tony, on my way out, I'll tell you that, you know, I was a young deadhead in 82, 83, just beginning to understand them. And somebody put on the Live at Keystone for me. And that opened doors that I couldn't even believe, you know, to hear the music that Garcia was making when he wasn't with the Grateful Dead and how wonderful that all was. And, you know, this is music that impacts us years later that our kids listen to. You know, so it's a wonderful thing that they've accomplished. It's great you're carrying on the tradition. And really, thank you so much for being on the show with us. Tony Saunders, everyone, please check out his music. Please check out anything he does. It's well worth it. And we will look forward to having you back on the show very soon. So good luck with all of your work. To our listener,
thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir. Thank you. And all of our listeners, as always, thanks for joining us. We will have more great stuff for you in the weeks to come. Have a great week. Take care of yourself and enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Thanks.